Hello and a very big welcome to the Tortoise Shack Live Sunday Special, where we dissect and maybe rant a bit about the week that's been, the events and the news. There'll be some special guests sneaking in at times. We'll have a Q&A for our lovely patrons at the end. So this week, we've got Tony and Martin from the Echo Chamber podcast, Caroline from the Glow Web podcast, Linda from the Pack Woman podcast, and me from Policed in Ireland. It's been another amazing week of contact across the shack, from Peter McVerry to Vicky Phelan to the Debenham workers to women who've left Irish comedy. If you're joining us live, you're one of our favourite people, and I think we do have favourites around here, who's signed up to support the creation of this work. If you haven't yet, please go to www.patreon.com/tortoiseshack and help us keep doing this work. We've tons we're going to get to this week, but Tony, going to start with you. You wanted to pick up on something that Peter McVerry said during the podcast, didn't you?
Martin and Peter had a good laugh about it, but there was an edge to it where they spoke about, Martin was making the point about the new Taoiseach from Cork, and Peter said he's from the other end of the country, and they had a laugh and they said, the part of the country we don't want to know about, and we don't know about, and we don't want to know about. And this trend is getting more and more prevalent in Irish politics now, even to the point that we're seeing it this morning, where the Fine Gael's Twitter account has put out a 2-minute video calling Sinn Féin hypocrites on stuff in the north. And if I was someone in the north, first of all, Sinn Féin don't represent all of the people of the north. They just don't. You know, a lot of the decisions made in the Northern Assembly are actually diktats that come from Westminster. And whatever about the factual inaccuracies of it, I'd still be pissed off that my entire place in the hierarchy of politics is as a stick to beat Sinn Féin with. And it's just really disheartening. And we speak to people all the time. We have loads of listeners who listen across the island of Ireland, including up north. And I just feel it's disrespectful to just say that this is what's happening. And it's happening now with the Taoiseach, the Tánaiste, and as I said this morning, the 2-minute video from the Fine Gael's official account. And I just, you know, we were talking to, I was talking to Aoife Moore before this started, and we saw Mary McAleese's comments yesterday saying in that terrific interview she gave with the Irish Times, saying that, you know, no one really cares. We're just up there. And like, Vicky, you lived there for 7 years. You know more than I do, but it's got to be disheartening.
Yeah. And like, I mean, it was a lesson for me when I moved there, just how little I knew about Northern Ireland. I mean, I never felt so ignorant in my life as when I first lived there, and the things I had to learn in all of that. And I think, yeah, like, you know, so much, I mean, the North and Brexit and all of that, like, it's such a huge issue in the next while. And we just, people are speaking with a lot of ignorance and really don't understand, you know, the everyday life and politics in the North.
It has to be something that we need to be cognizant of, especially 3 weeks from Brexit, as you said. I know it's not true, like it's December 31st, but the no deal thing is rapidly approaching. And the reality for Ireland is very, very difficult to stomach. And we need an all-Ireland approach. And we won't get that if our politics is based on this division and this using it as a political, like, I mean, people keep saying don't politicize it, but everything is political, you know. Sport is political, culture is political, but please let's be better than this. Let's pull together. And it's just disappointing to see that continue to come.
The approach to Brexit can't be about we're worried about Sinn Féin being in government down here, you know. But we're going to move quickly on from that, because we're really delighted to be joined by Lord Mayor of Dublin, Hazel Chew. Thanks so much for joining us today on the pod.
Thank you for having me. Sorry, I look a bit frazzled, and today is technically family day, so I've just spent all morning running after a 3-year-old. Thank you for rescuing me. I haven't put any makeup on or dressed for the occasion, just to warn you.
So. Welcome to the team.
I can see it's only above head there, Tony, so like, we didn't even get to see what you're wearing.
I have a t-shirt on for once.
Oh, good. good.
Yeah, but we've already been subjected to topless photos this morning. So, you know, we're already scarred. But hey, so thanks so much for taking the time out. There's a couple of things we'd like to chat to you about, but I know the first meeting of the Just Transition group was held yesterday. And I suppose we'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because it must be a really difficult time in the Greens with this kind of dissonance about being in government but trying to achieve certain things.
It is, and you know what, it is difficult. We've all acknowledged it. There's an opportunity. There's opportunity to be there, but that opportunity is dependent on people uniting and also working together within government across all parties. I think we mentioned Brexit there, and the need for unity and the need for people to kind of put aside discourse. And I think we need that right now as well. But in terms of the Greens, there was a good AGM. It was very well run. I hosted the panel with Eileen Evian and also with Anthony Flynn, both of whom I knew from other stuff anyway. I'm hoping to work with Eileen on travelers' rights through this office. And I'm also working with Anto on the Homeless Task Force. He was one of the first people I wanted on the Homeless Task Force that we set up here in the Lord Mayor's office, because the man has been living, breathing it, and he's been brilliant. So the day itself went really well. There's a committee formed. This is the thing. It is a affiliate group of the Green Party, just like all the other affiliate groups, like Manon Glossa, which is the women's group that myself and Grace and Catherine and a few others set up a few years ago, the Young Greens, the Queer Greens. And this is why, like, we have various groups within the party. It kind of allows for better discussion, better debate, views across the board. So it's good to have. I encourage every party to have random, not random groups, but good kind of groups to promote discussion among their members.
Yesterday was the Just Transition Greens were kind of set up it reminds me of the Remainers, who didn't want to go with the within the Tory party in a way. But there's also an element of, you know, people speaking about it. I mean, Lorna Bogue made a very good speech yesterday in relation to some of the things that are disappointing in what's happening. And I know you as the Lord Mayor of Dublin, which is fantastic, but you know, it says something, and we were trying to achieve so much in this, but there has to be a cognitive dissonance there of being the people who have to hold the government's feet to the fire and be in government.
Yes. I think that's why it's important to have that. It's important to have groups, but also members within the Green Party who may not be members of Just Transition or themselves, that are kind of raising issues and questioning issues within government. You can't have everyone that's just singing from the same hymn sheet. You do need, when it comes to unity and being able to work together, that voting wise, that's what you've gone into. But on other topics during any given time, you're supposed to ask questions. You're supposed to raise it. That is your role as well as working together. So, and to your point of now more than ever. So, and thanks for comparing us to the Tories. That was particularly.
Oh, sorry.
Green Party Tories, Green Party Sinn Féin on bikes. I didn't even have my bike until this week. So it's nice. Thanks, Tony. Thanks. So, but no, I agree with you. Like, listen, we all know where myself and Patrick, my partner, stood when it came to going into government. We weren't for it for many reasons. And right now, even though Patrick will be whipped to vote on issues, there doesn't mean he wouldn't be raising questions on things. And himself, NASA, other people within the government TDs would be. And I welcome that, because I think that's how you build for better and more democratic governing.
Can I move you along to speak to another issue? You were on the Late Late Show recently, and we've been talking a lot on the Shack here about, you know, some of the concerning trends, whether it's the increasing far right, events and protests, but also I know Linda wanted to talk about a racist attack in Dundalk. We've seen some issues in Balbriggan. I suppose as Lord Mayor, what are you kind of thinking about, you know, what can you achieve through your role in relation to that?
This is the thing. The year itself is a bit odd for the office. Usually in this office, and I've had my team tell me this several times at this stage, usually in the office, it's been primarily ceremonial. You go out, you open a pens, you cut some ribbons, you do. And due to COVID, there's no events, which is actually good on my part because there was a whole load of other stuff I wanted to do. But I was told, oh no, you'd be too busy kind of going to do that. So I've already had the chief executive told me not once, but three times at this stage going, oh, I've seen a lot of you and you have a lot of ass. And that's the thing. It's kind of and I loathe calling anything an opportunity during a time when people are dying. But there has been for me, thankfully, a space there and to do other stuff and to do stuff that's important. And to your point about racism, then what can we do instead of just shine a light and talk about it? I spoke to the Immigrant Council about this and I was doing a couple of sessions with them, and I will be speaking to INAR and I spoke to the Migrants Rights Centre, and we've been having these meetings where we go, right, lads, there's this whole reporting side of things. There is this whole raising awareness, but what do we need to do other than that? What can this office do? So we're looking at now how to push local authority, but also through this office here, how can we make sure it happens for the support side of after reporting a racist attack, of after, because I think we need to look at racism as from making sure we end it on one level, but making sure we support it on the other level. And right now what we're doing a lot of is calling it out when it happens, but then telling people to report, and then when reporting finishes, that not that that's it, but a lot of people find that it's there's nothing done. So where I stand is looking at the what happens after the reporting side. So hate crime is one thing. We need a hate crime legislation in place, and it's something myself and Patrick have both spoken to the Minister of Justice for, because Patrick is the spokesperson for justice for the Greens, and me in my position of Lord Mayor and having tied in with the legislation before launch with Charlie Flanagan when he was there, I would be pushing for it to happen sooner rather than later. The other step is making sure we have supports in places for when people do report, because a lot of times it falls through the gap when it comes to Garda reporting. The second thing is when it comes to INAR reporting, the INAR does an amazing job, but then the next step of, well, you've just been physically or verbally abused, what can we do to support you then? So I know Dill and Amory had set up a counselling service previously, and they do a lot of supports for post kind of trauma of people who have been abused kind of racially. So we need more of that. That's what we're looking at.
I'm guessing Linda's really going to want to say something about that, because she does so much work with victims of sexual violence reporting and the needs for support. So do you want to say something there, Linda?
Yeah, absolutely. And Hazel, this is great to hear that we're really pushing for that, because we've seen this week a family who have been forced out of their home, who have been reporting for the last 3 years. And there seems to be very little done in terms of helping them. And we had a mother of a young boy beaten with a baseball bat outside her house. And since they've left the house is still under attack. And they're, you know, the consistent message seems to be go home to your own country. The child is raised in Ireland, born and raised in Ireland. This is his country. So I think anything supportive that we can do for victims, and, you know, any kind of victimization causes trauma. And we don't talk enough about supporting people through trauma. You know, we talk about getting them justice and maybe getting them some support. And it's something I'm seeing, because I'm doing more and more go-alongs with victims to the Garda station to do the reporting and stuff like that. And it's great, because I'm doing quite a bit of work with the DPSU unit, which is specifically trained to deal with victims. And the difference that I see from what was there before to what's there now is huge, because they're very much about, do you have access to counselling? There's all this stuff in the booklet here. You know, you've got somebody from the Victims Alliance with you. So, you know, make sure you use them and find out where you can get the supports and stuff like that. So there is in every single interview, every single statement taken that I've done recently, there is an element of, have you got the supports in place and how can we help you to find those? Which is brilliant coming from a Garda Síochána, because it is a much more holistic approach. So I think something like that, some maybe specialist kind of unit like that, is definitely something that we could use, where people have been trained specifically to deal with people who've been victimized in a certain way.
I think sorry, Hazel.
No, Vicky, I was just saying to that exact point, it's why when we look at hate crime, that's something that we have raised constantly to the minister, and I'll be raising with the Garda Commissioner as well, because they need to push on that side, that you can't just set up a new legislation and then not set up a department to handle it as well, because what will happen is inevitably it'll go through this system per usual, and then there is no, as you said, the immediate thing of having people understand how to do a report, how as someone who would be a victim, then how do you report? Would there be language barriers? What are the supports afterwards? What are your what actually comes out of this needs to be explained. But again, and that's why I fully agree with you. I think that's one of the biggest gaps we have, and we need to start looking at it now, even before bringing down any legislation on anything. Sorry,
Hazel, thanks so much for joining us this morning. I think we could talk to you all day, and maybe someone will get you on one of their pods again soon to talk to you, but we'll move on from that if that's okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hazel, thank you so much, and I know we were under pressure, because I know it's family day, so thanks for taking time out for it.
No worries. Thanks, guys.
Caroline, did you have a comment? Sorry, I just...
It was just to pick up, I suppose, on Hazel's point there about the therapy aspect. And, of course, I'm always a massive fan of therapy, and everyone should have access to low-cost, ethically trained therapists. But I think there's a point to be made in that a lot of therapists who are white aren't understanding the specific issues that are faced by people of colour, and therefore they are re-traumatising people of colour who are coming to them for therapy around issues of racism and things like that. So I think that we need to A, have a more diverse pool of therapists available in Ireland, and B, more training on what anti-racism actually is for therapists, because I know that that's not covered in a lot of therapist training courses. And there's a lot of extra work to be done around that. But just again, to minimize that potential of re-traumatizing people, and there's been some Twitter threads on it during the week, and, you know, some white therapists making some very unethical comments or comparing racism to experience that they've had, and white people can't know what it's like to be targeted for the color of your skin in Ireland. So again, just making sure that, you know, that awareness is there, that we need to also include therapists in training, such as like with guards or the legislation, and, you know, training the support services to make sure that they're actually where we'd like them to be.
Yeah, just quickly on that one, before I leave you, I know you want to move on, but on that one, Caroline, just, I guess, on a personal level, I remember when my brother, I picked him up from A&E in Tala, because he had got hopped on by a bunch of kids, and his arm was broken, his ribs were broken, mainly because his skin was yellow, and they called out to that. They called him a jink and said, well, you know, you don't belong here. When so I was his guardian, so I brought him to a therapist just to make sure there was no post-traumatic trauma there. And I was really, really livid when he told me that one of the sessions, the therapist had kind of said to him, well, you know, it's just a bit of rough and tumble. It's boys kind of, that's what happens. It was never touched on why it happened or like that. And the same with my mother as well. Whenever she had gone to counseling sessions, because she got quite a bit of physical as well as verbal abuse, that it was always questioned on, well, should you be working in this area rather than, well, why are the causes of this? And I think it's really important that if we are to be a society where we're anti-racist, where we're actually standing up to this, then across the board, through the levels of support, especially with counselling support, Gardaí support, any support, that people understand and see it from the victim's point of view, exactly why. And one of the whys is because they have a certain skin colour, they come from a minority background, and we need to start understanding from that. So yeah, absolutely. Anyway, I'm gonna go, so sorry about
thank
that
you. Thank
so
you.
There's a whole other issue there with we have a voluntary accreditation process for councillors in Ireland, but we don't have regulation or licensing, and that's a big issue. Okay, thank you, Hazel. We're gonna jump that to Madrid, I think, are we, Tony?
Yeah, give me one second, I just need to
So we're going to be joined by Joe Haslam, who's currently in Madrid, which as far as we know, has the highest rates of coronavirus in Europe. And we thought it'd be great to hear a little bit about what life in Madrid is like at the moment and how it's being managed. Is Joe there?
Yeah, I'm here. Do I get a picture or is I a radio?
If you want.
A radio face. I'm a face for radio. Okay, anyway, start my video. Okay.
There you go.
Hey.
It's not that frightening, really. What Linda says is correct, which is to say that there is a cluster, that we're, you know, according to the statistics, the worst place in Europe. Now, there's what happens is that, of course, instead of actually talking about fixing the situation, everyone's talking about whether the statistics are right or wrong, which is why I don't like having a big discussion about whether statistics are based on statistics. I mean, whether they're very high, they're still bad. And we still have a situation where they're getting worse. The former head of public health resigned, and in her kind of, which is a very un-Spanish thing to do, when she was leaving, she tweeted a scene from the Titanic whereby the people were playing Nearer My God to Thee and heading for lifeboats. So, you know, this is sort of the situation where there's a big debate between sort of the Madrid government and then the national government, and who's responsible, and everyone is spinning and everyone is discussing statistics, and nobody is, you know, there's no calls for kind of, actually, this is a problem that's getting worse every day we wait. So it's, it's not nice at all. And it's, you know, it's usually Madrid is a very nice place. And usually when people contact me, I look out and tell them how great the weather is. But this is the situation when I look out, and even though the sun is shining, you know, it's not a great place to be at all.
How is the weather, Joe?
Well, the weather is always dependable, Martin. You don't need to worry about that. But, you know, there is kind of lockdowns between different zones. You can't move between the different areas. I mean, there has been a kind of Madrid was never really had a north-south divide. I mean, it's something that's become very evident, but now it's become very evident. And you have this kind of really difficult situation whereby you have in one area of Madrid, people are protesting against the police and who are restricting them from going to their places of work, or whatever. And then in, shall we say, the wealthier, or use whatever term you like, you have people just, you know, claiming we're all being harassed and all this kind of stuff. So you have in two different parts of the city, two different groups of people complaining for opposite reasons.
And apart from that, Joe, yeah, the Supreme Court there last week or this week came out with a big decision. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that you've been talking about for a long time. And I mean, it absolutely speaks to what we've been talking about, whereby when a lot of people come, particularly from Latin America, they end up working as riders for one of the food delivery apps. And, you know, this is a way of kind of this is a way in which they can get working and get income very quickly. And a lot of these people are living in one area of the city, but they often, you know, they do like a lot of immigrants do. I mean, you know, I don't know whether I'm allowed to say, let's say I may have worked illegally in the United States at some stage during my summer holidays. But we may have been a big group of Irish people, and we may have been like hot bedding, like so in some sense, I understand exactly what people do. So what this is that you have this kind of a situation whereby if the government wanted to actually act, there's a judicial decision as well as, you know, what's causing the problem, which is to say that you have a lot of people who are, you know, need to get to different parts of Madrid in order to do their work. Now, what happened with the Supreme Court, of course, there's a long way between a Supreme Court decision and it will probably be appealed and then it will have to go into legislation. But it is quite interesting that, you know, it's not a sort of a small court. It's actually the Supreme Court, and it's a court. It's a, something that has been coming for a while. So it has now become impossible to ignore. But the situation doesn't change overnight. But it's certainly, you know, very clear in which direction it's going.
And that decision was that these guys are employees, not self-employed. That was the big decision from the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
Martin, go on, say it. They're not bogus self-employed.
Well, they were bogus self-employed, but now it's been proven. And I suppose that's the first time Madrid has addressed it in the Supreme Court. We addressed it in the Supreme Court back in 1998. We've known this since 1998, since the Denny case, that you can't make decisions on groups and classes of workers like that. You have to take one on each one on an individual basis. They may be employees, they may be self-employed, but what the government can't do and the state can't do is say, you're all self-employed. You can't do that. And the Supreme Court in Spain has just upheld that tenet, but it's something we've known for 20 years here in Ireland, and yet we're worse than Spain for bogus self-employment. Worse.
Is there a question there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, in the area of bogus self-employment, I'm not going to go up against Martin. I don't have the firepower or the credibility. So, humble business school professor.
Can we bring it to one thing, Joe? A couple of things. Yeah. So there's been people, I saw four cases in Barcelona where people were reinfected with COVID. I've seen numbers that are in like extraordinary high positive tests, and we need a lot more. It's enough to say, like, you know, people say, oh, the second wave, well within the second wave. France is going the same way. The UK is going the same way. Should we have, like, I mean, I don't know. What's your thought process on this? What steps do you think are working and what could we learn?
Well, I was supposed to be speaking last week in Korea at a conference, so we ended up doing it online. So I was asking the people in Korea a lot about, you know, what they're doing. And that seems to be the sort of the model. Now, everyone talks about, you know, the fact that Korea had previous instances of these types of diseases and was able to prepare a lot better. But what's happening in Spain is that, you know, there's this line, you know, again, just another connection with Korea from the movie Parasite, which is to say, you know, what plan always works, and that's no plan. And that's kind of where we are in Spain. There's just very little options as to what they can do. And you have this big debate between, you know, the people who are like, oh, they open up the economy people, and then you have the people who are like another lockdown. And it's just very difficult because, you know, there's in Spain, everyone wears masks in public, but they sort of feel as if that's a sort of a vulnerability shield, that if I wear a mask in public, then I'm a do-gooder, you know, therefore, and then they go to a restaurant and then they take off the mask and then they you know, then they perhaps get contaminated and then they go back and they hug their children. And there's it is difficult for the government. And in this part, I do feel sympathy that, you know, everything that's been great about Spain, everything from the contact between the grandparents and their grandchildren, you know, there's some, you know, all of these kind of social things, everything that's good about Spain is almost directly makes handling COVID to be a problem. So that's the sort of what they're trying to face. But the only way through it is TTI, you know, track and trace. That's the only thing to do. But, you know, you were the second most visited country in the world. The economy relies on tourism. It's just really difficult in order what to do. The other issue, of course, is the rivalry between the national government, which is this, you know, the Labour Party, the socialist government, and then Madrid, which is run by the Partido Popular, which are, you know, I guess, Christian Democrat, Fine Gael. And there is a kind of a tension between those two things. And then, of course, as Tony, the whole Catalonia thing comes into it, because, of course, one is trying to demonstrate competence and the other is
don't
is
pick on
to,
me and my, and my separatist.
But I just every time I speak to you guys, I end up talking to Martin about bogus self-employment, and I'm talking to Tony about Catalonia, basically.
I'll shift it then, because one of the things we wanted to talk about Ireland today is the issue of track and trace, and you might want to stay on the line for this, but there's a lot of problems emerging with this week. I don't know, Martin or Caroline, if you want to pick up on this.
Yeah, it's we were told at the height of it back in April that they could have up to 1,700 people doing track and trace. At the moment, we're in the low hundreds doing contact tracing. The game hasn't been upped. In fact, they've wound it down, thinking, I don't know what, that this was going to go away, that there'd be no second wave. It's very short-termism, and now we're paying the price for it. We don't know where the outbreaks are coming from when it says community outbreaks. So we're told, oh, it's household outbreaks, but you don't know where they're coming from. So how can you say that? There's a lack of clarity. There's a lack of data to tell us where it's going wrong, where we need to act most. And it's a huge deficit on the part of the state, huge.
Caroline, what happened in your own case? Because, you know, you tested positive.
I tested positive back in March. Finally started feeling better last week. Yay. I don't need afternoon naps at the moment. Fingers crossed. But, yeah, I was never contacted to do the tracing aspect. So I was told I was a potential risk and I had to get a test through the HSE. Some poor army guy that I had to explain that my body temperature might be raised because my period, and he was not able for that information at all. The joy of periods. But again, once I tested positive, there is absolutely no further contact. It was just my doctor saying, yeah, you're positive, and me then freaking out. But that was it. So I don't really have a lot of faith in the track and trace system. I just don't, because I've seen that it's not actually there. And we're not tracking also, you know, we do have to track the infection thing, but we're not also tracking the long haulers and seeing what the impact is on the people who aren't sick enough to be in the post-COVID clinic, but the people like myself, who've like struggled with the fatigue and the brain fog and weirdly itchy skin and hair loss for 6 months. Like, I'm not sick enough, thankfully, to be in a clinic, but that still should be captured in some sort of research somewhere, you know, again, to like build up that picture of this isn't just a 2 week thing. You know, and we need to have that conversation.
And there's a real issue here when decisions are being made about levels and stages of lockdown, but on what basis are those decisions being made? If not everyone is being tracked and traced, and then if it's not getting into the level of detail that would actually tell us, is this about pubs? Is this about sports or whatever? And we don't have that information. And yet, you know, just this on Friday, me and all my university colleagues get told that on Monday morning, instead of doing face-to-face teaching, we now have to do online teaching. So every academic in the country is spending their weekend working, because that's not an easy shift. And every student in the country is going, but what about money I paid on rent and accommodation? And this is happening for 2 or 3 weeks. And is that going to be drip fed again? But again, what is the basis for saying this? There's a real question about the data that's, and I know, Joe, you said you didn't want to talk about the veracity of statistics, but we do have to have proper information on which to base these decisions, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my point is that, like, you know, it's when, you know, if the tree is falling on top of you, you don't say, is it an oak or is it an ash? You kind of try and you get out of the way of the falling tree. And that was my poorly articulated point. But there's a whole pile of issues and to do with the legal issues as well. I mean, in Korea, one of the things they can do is that there is a lot of compliance. Everyone signs up to the app. It's pretty, I imagine, from a civil liberties point of view, there's not many considerations taken. And that is one of the issues of the discussion as to where the line goes. I mean, how much of our civil liberties are we prepared to give up in order that we could kind of keep the rates down? Now, we should have been having that conversation last March or last June, when it was very obvious this was happening. But, you know, in Spain, everyone sort of like, we locked down, we got the rate down, and then everyone went on holidays and nothing happened. And, you know, the airports were open, the ports were open. I think the big difference between Ireland and Spain is that, you know, Ireland could go for a kind of a zero COVID type solution, you know, with that, because as an island, that's a possibility, whereas it's not really a possibility for Spain. I mean, there's a lot of people in Spain, the government doesn't even know they're here. I think that's less the case in Ireland. So it's just really difficult to know what you can do in terms of Spain. And also, you see, like, it's funny listening to Hazel about the Lord Mayor of Cork, and or Lord Mayor of Dublin, where am I saying? But, you know, that her job was kind of ceremonial. And a lot of the politicians sort of signed up or got into politics expecting to have a ceremonial role. You know, they didn't expect that, you know, they'd be ending up like in the movie Contagion. And they're just completely inequipped for it. And they're good at opening, smiling, being non-threatening, all of those kind of things. And they're not really having to kind of turn into this kind of posture of telling people you can't leave your house, or you can't do this, or you can't do your this. And they're also, you have this kind of issue about just sometimes the ability to put up your hand and ask for help is something that a lot of people don't really have. So it's a very difficult situation. I actually don't think anything will happen. I just think Spain will muddle through. I think the people will die. The ICUs will be overcrowded. And I think people will just sort of say nothing could have been done and, you know, sort of hope something turns up, hope a vacuum turns up. But there's no, you know, going back to Parasite, you know, no one wants to be accused of trying something. There was the famous case in the last outbreak where a French minister saw, you know, I think it was the previous version of SARS coming, and she stocked up on all this equipment, and then it didn't come, and she had to resign because the people accused her of wasting all this money on equipment that wasn't necessary. You also have, I guess, the whole private public thing, which is to say that the orthodoxy of the Partido Popular is very much based on, you know, giving contracts to private organizations. Everything is sort of do nothing, and then there's a problem, and then use kind of, I guess, what's, you know, called disaster capitalism to say, like, we need to build a hospital or buy this fantastic equipment, or like, what nobody won't do is set up people to do track and trace. You know, it's always a wonder solution, turn something, an ice rink, into a hospital or something like that. So it's really difficult situation. I mean, part of me is very critical of the politicians. Part of me is very critical also because I know what public opinion lies and the difficulty of doing that. And I just think nothing will happen. I just think we'll muddle through and sort of hope something will turn up.
Well, I mean, that's not a very cheery conclusion, but it is a deeply contextualized one. And I think it's really important thinking about where the public are in their thoughts around this and where politicians have found themselves and, you know, the unknowns around the disease and so on. So thanks a million, Joe, for joining us from Madrid and for those contributions. One of the things Joe mentioned there that I'd like to pick up on this week is, you know, politicians finding themselves in unexpected positions, perhaps, and needing a bit of help and advice. And, you know, I think we can all get on board with that. And we all want our politicians to have the expertise that they need at their hands so that they're doing the best job possible. But I'm just, these numbers and, you know, Aoife Grace Moore, again, doing great work on telling us about this. But the big thing for me is the lack of transparency around it and the fact that they're handpicking people. The salaries are like, I can't even keep a whole lot of track around that. But like, there's no public sector job that you can walk into like that in Ireland. Like, are these not public sector jobs? Should they not be advertised? Should there not be, you know, a transparent appointment process? And should there not be clarity? Should there not be rules around who can have them and how many they can have and so on? Am I on my own on this one?
I think it's become a status thing, and it's kind of a communist status thing. I have the best car. I have the best driver. I have 8 advisors. And it is this one-upmanship. I am the most, and Eamon Ryan, thank God Hazel's gone. Eamon Ryan with 8 advisors. 8 advisors. I mean, for what? To keep them awake? You know, it's ridiculous stuff. Ridiculous.
My biggest concern with it is how many of these people are actually going to be spin doctors? Like, are we actually getting into that level of US politics where all the advisors are just putting out spin, and we're seeing it? Like, it's actually happening. So it'd be interesting to see of them who and what they are and what their role is and where their expertise lies.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for, you know, ministers having somebody to help them with how to deliver messages and so on. But really, the core of that expertise should be about the subject matter that they're dealing with and that they're engaging in. So, I think there's a lot of need for transparency around that issue. And I imagine we'll come back to that once we have a bit more data. Caroline, you're going to change the mood a little, aren't you? Back to sex.
I'm going back on mute.
It always comes back to sex with you, Caroline. Okay, what do you want to tell us about? This is the extremely disturbing and very gross news that during the week in Vietnam, the police seized over 300,000 used condoms that had been washed out, reshapen by putting them on a wooden dildo and rolled back up again and sold. And now this raises so many questions. It's a woman in charge. She said she's getting paid 17 cents American money per kilogram for the condoms. But like, where do you find 320,000 used condoms? Like what?
Tony's headboard.
Well, I have to say it made me think of Adeline Berry telling us that the guards were seizing condoms as proof of sex.
Oh, so maybe this is a way to get extra funds in the system. I just,
Martin, like, I am disgusted.
Like, they found together that amount of condoms weighed 360 kilograms. And like, that's a lot of sperm to be washing out of a condom to resell. Sorry for that graphic image, but this is more reason why we need to have sex education, and hopefully someone would realise maybe this isn't the wisest thing in the world to do, no matter the money and the financial gain that you might get. Maybe being elbow deep in like a lot of strangers' semen is not a good way to go.
And vaginal discharge as well.
Yeah, that's also true. The one thing about it though is like this is just another case for why we need free condoms everywhere.
Yeah,
like if they're free, then there won't be a need.
And I think yesterday was Contraception Day, wasn't it? And seeing this week, the lot of universities like Maynooth and stuff are rolling out active consent workshops. But yeah, just conversations to use condoms.
Simon McGarr made the point that he was all for the old deposit scheme, bottle deposit scheme, but is firmly against it extending into this area. I will not correct Simon.
Okay, so before we open up our Q&A, we're going to have a repeat of our new feature, which is Culture Corner. And I'm going to take the liberty to go first and my all Irish week, which is the new Pillow Queens album is amazing. If you haven't listened to it yet, please go listen. Just fantastic. But this week I devoured in about 2 days, I like just completely gulped down Louise O'Neill's After the Silence, which is just fantastic. I think her writing gets better and better with every book that she does. But what's really nice about this is like some of her books are really intense. They're a slap in the face and they're hard to read. This is a story that's very much about domestic violence and different forms of domestic violence. But it doesn't have that slap in the face dimension to it, I thought. It has much more of an overriding story, which is kind of a murder mystery, which I think kind of makes it a bit more easier. It's not quite so jarring to read. But it's fantastic. And this nice kind of thread in Irish literature at the moment, Caroline O'Donoghue's new book as well, both of them set on islands. And there's a lot of like fun stuff about, you know, Irish islands and their culture and heritage and sense of community and everything. So I thoroughly recommend that. Who else has some culture they want to throw our way?
I was going to say, I recorded a podcast during the week with Caroline Lloyd, who is the grief geek. Gave me her book, which is Grief Demystified. And I have to say, if you have somebody who's ill, or somebody, if you've recently been bereaved, and obviously we have an awful lot of people who are bereaved at the moment, it is a really good bridge between kind of some academic stuff around grief and how it works and what we normally perceive. And I think it's really key. And it's a really easy read for anybody out there who's bereaved or grief stricken. So not quite as nice, but very informative and well worth reading.
Just on a bit of entertainment, The Old Guard, a movie with Charlize Theron in it. It's good. It's well worth the watch. If you want to waste an hour and a half just letting your brain melt away, brilliant. Go ahead and watch it.
Brain melts are very necessary.
Joe, are you reading anything good in Madrid, no?
I don't know. This is what I just got. I just got this one about...
The Impossible Dream. By Barry. He's the Sunday Business Post.
Yeah. So I just got, and I also read the John Delaney book as well. So it's funny. I'm 15 years in Madrid, and here am I reading about John Delaney and Sean McCarthy. So, you know, I always say it's a bit like James Joyce, who, you know, left Ireland here, comparing myself to James Joyce, left Ireland and never stopped writing about Dublin, you know. But anyway, it's a sort of like, I'm like a lot of expats. We're professional Irish people, you know. We like Irishness is completely wasted in Ireland, you know. Go abroad and you become a superpower by talking about Ireland. So that's, go ahead.
I was gonna be all highbrow and plug the Age of Surveillance Capitalism, and I will eventually, but I'm just gonna stop that and say I've sat the kids down and watched all of season one of Cobra Kai now. So if I'm late to the show, it is nostalgia gold with a little bit of social commentary, which is really good. Caroline.
Mine is related to sex. No surprises there. This is my, I feel like I'm betraying the Shack, but I do listen to other podcasts outside the Shack. And this, I found this music via the Delisted podcast, which is all about bitchy celebrity gossip, my favorite. Mm-hmm. And this was recommended by the host, Michael Kay, it's the album, What's Your Pleasure by Jesse Ware. And he said it's like very Studio 54 vibes, but it's music to watch an orgy by while you're stoned and watching everyone have a good time. And actually that description is quite apt. You know, I'm not doing either of those things at the moment, being around people or consuming drugs or watching orgies or being in orgies, but I appreciate the vibe of it. So it's very chill. And
are orgies even possible under the current regulations?
Technically, no.
Yeah.
The key there is technically there are some swingers parties started up again in the UK. Make of that what you will, but yeah, very irresponsible.
Dogging is safe. Dogging is still safe.
Dogging and glory holds. Like, is literal medical advice at the moment.
It's funny. I was on Google Maps looking for something, and I saw on the Google Maps they had like swingers club, and I went, I clicked on that, and then there were like reviews of the swingers club. You know, and like Google Maps, you could see like the person and their name and saying like, you know, I like people to watch me. Like I was like, Google Maps, when I thought that'd be like the dark web or something. But, you know, very mainstream people, like just very critical of saying, you know, I demand an audience. The club was nice, but you know, it just wasn't enough of an audience.
And a nine, but if you have 9 euro chicken wings, I believe you can do it now. Right.
Okay, I'm going to say a big thanks to Joe and Hazel for joining us for really great contributions today. If you're listening back, please do head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and give us some support, and we'll keep doing these great Sunday specials and keep producing all of the excellent content across the Shack. So thanks very much for everyone today.
That is where we leave you for another week, folks. It was another rip-roaring Sunday special. The full version, including the Q&A with our listeners, which is always so amazing, that the quality of the people who listen to these podcasts and come along always gives me imposter syndrome, is available at patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I just want to say thanks to those people who put their hands in their pockets. Thousands of you listen, thousands of you, and it takes a lot of time and effort to put these things out into the world. But you know what? Doing these things, there's a little bit of give back, and it's great just to be able to give back to the people who put their hands in their pockets. Thanks for the support. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.